Buenos días y bienvenidos a esta 26ª edición de nuestro seminario sobre seguridad y defensa, que ya es un clásico y yo creo que prácticamente el único seminario abierto al público y de estas características que se desarrolla en nuestro país, donde tradicionalmente pues se presta poca atención a estas cuestiones, siempre realmente importantes. Un año más nos reunimos aquí en este parador de Toledo para abordar algunas cuestiones interesantes y siguiendo la tradición es que al final somos periodistas, los organizadores, la Asociación de Periodistas Europeos, pues mantenemos un poco la idea de la actualidad. Una de las claves del éxito que el seminario ha tenido, ya son 26 años, no es muy frecuente que un seminario alcance esta edición, es que siempre ha procurado cada año mantenerse fiel a la actualidad, a los temas que puedan interesar más cada año, en cada momento, que ha ido cambiando continuamente. Si cuando ahora nos hablará Miguel Ángel Aguilar, que es el director del seminario, aparte del secretario general de la Asociación de Periodistas Europeos, ¿cómo fueron los comienzos del seminario? Y evidentemente hace 26 años, 30, porque hubo algún año que no se celebró, que no se desarrolló. Hablar de algunas cuestiones que van a ser abordadas hoy, pues será como, no sé, absolutamente utópico. Todas estas cuestiones de ciberseguridad, pues en ese momento yo creo que la mayor parte de las personas no teníamos ni idea de que se planteaban y que existían. Pero si ustedes recuerdan, y ahí están los libros que se publican después de cada edición del seminario para recordarlo y para perpetuarlo, pues cada año hemos ido cambiando los temas en función de la actualidad nacional, internacional, sobre temas concretos, pero siempre siguiendo la actualidad. Y este año pues vamos a abordar el tema de las ciberamenazas. Sabemos que tanto en el ámbito de la defensa como en el de la seguridad, y por supuesto también en el ámbito de la vida civil, de la actividad económica, de la actividad empresarial, esta es una cuestión enormemente interesante. Y lo peor es que es enormemente preocupante, porque hay una serie de riesgos, de peligros que están ahí, que no se detienen. Y sobre esto es sobre lo que queríamos pues volcar hoy y mañana, en estas dos jornadas, el desarrollo del seminario. Para eso pues contamos, como ustedes podrán ver en el programa, con especialistas en diferentes aspectos de la cuestión. Y bueno, esperamos que una vez más sea realmente interesante. También quiero aprovechar, antes de pasarle la palabra a Miguel Ángel Aguilar, para presentarles, como también viene siendo un poco habitual ya, el libro que se ha editado con las ponencias y las intervenciones del año pasado, que el título fue Intervenciones e inhibiciones. Lo tienen ustedes todos en la mesa. Fuera también, en la mesa de entrada, pues hay libros, si desean llevar alguno más, pues están a su entera disposición. Con todo lo que hablemos aquí en estas próximas horas, en las ponencias que algunos de ustedes van a desarrollar y en las intervenciones que todos puedan tener, todos están invitados a participar con preguntas, con reflexiones, con intervenciones de diferente tipo, con todo esto se volverá a editar un libro para el año que viene. Por eso les pido a todos que las intervenciones que tengan siempre anticipen el nombre y el cargo de quien la formula, para que en la grabación que se está haciendo de todas las intervenciones quede constancia y se pueda ser recogido así después cuando se proceda a la redacción definitiva del libro. Quiero aprovechar fundamentalmente para darles la bienvenida, para decir que estamos encantados que un año más la respuesta, tanto por parte de militares como de representaciones extranjeras, como también de expertos interesados en las cuestiones de seguridad y de defensa, pues se siga manteniendo en el mismo nivel de todos los años, es decir, que el interés por el seminario no decae, lo cual para nosotros es una satisfacción y un estímulo para seguir trabajando sobre estas cuestiones y para seguir preparando ya, pensando ya en el seminario del próximo año. Así que quiero agradecérselo muy especialmente, desearles una buena estancia aquí en Toledo. La verdad es que parece que el tiempo no nos está acompañando demasiado, pero la verdad es que estamos en un sitio muy agradable que contribuye de manera muy especial pues a que estas sesiones resulten, además de interesantes, pues también amenas y confortables. Bienvenidos, por lo tanto, muchas gracias por atender a nuestra convocatoria un año más. Y ahora Miguel Ángel Aguilar, que es quien ha asumido la elaboración del programa y que llevará la dirección del desarrollo del seminario, podrá explicarnos con mayor detalle todo lo que pueda afectar al desarrollo. Adelante, Miguel Ángel.
Muchas gracias, presidente. Muchas gracias a todos los que han acudido a esta convocatoria, que, como Diego ha dicho, tiene esa tradición, cumple su 26ª edición. Y cómo ha surgido la idea original del seminario, pues surgió como el propósito de crear un espacio de relaciones, y de contacto y de reflexión inteligente sobre asuntos de la defensa. Unos asuntos que estamos hablando de 1983, la Asociación de Periodistas Europeos, la sección española había nacido 2 años antes, en el año 1981, pues unos asuntos que estaban creando, que estaban supurando unos problemas de desentendimiento, porque de un lado los componentes de las Fuerzas Armadas, los profesionales de los ejércitos, de otro los profesionales de la información, los periodistas, se habían antagonizado de una manera muy visible y muy extrema. Yo pude resumir esta situación en algunas conversaciones con el general Gutiérrez Mellado, que venía de más atrás, diciéndole: todos los periodistas piensan que todos los militares son golpistas, los militares piensan que todos los periodistas son hijos de puta. Entonces, partiendo de ese nivel tan bajo, pues intentamos modificar esa situación utilizando eso que se llama, que describió con tanta lucidez Lidl-Harr, la estrategia de la aproximación indirecta. Nunca hablamos de relaciones entre periodistas y militares, siempre hablamos de asuntos donde podía identificarse un interés por una reflexión común vista desde distintos ángulos. Los temas que han dado, en fin, que han titulado cada una de estas ediciones, pues se han discutido, se han preparado, y han sido siempre el resultado de un proceso de interacción con nuestros buenos amigos y asesores de diferentes procedencias, porque no se trata solo de convocar periodistas y profesionales de las Fuerzas Armadas, también diplomáticos, también profesores, también las gentes de ese mundo de los think tanks, también gentes del mundo de las empresas de la defensa, de la industria de la defensa, y de esa conversación se va acotando cuál debe ser el asunto central de la edición, de cada una de las ediciones. El seminario yo creo que ha tenido muy buenas anticipaciones. Aquí tuvimos, por ejemplo, a Hélène Carrer d'Ancos, aquella maravillosa francesa, única, creo yo, que anticipó el derrumbe del gigante soviético con su libro L'Empire Éclaté, cuando estaba declinando, pero sin embargo se exageraba su posición y sus posibilidades. Tuvo la valentía de plantearlo con acierto, de establecer cuáles eran sus vulnerabilidades y cómo iban a pasar enseguida factura. Pero también tuvimos a Salomé Zurabichvili, que entonces era la asesora del Quai d'Orsay de defensa, y luego recuperó su nacionalidad georgiana y fue ministra de Asuntos Exteriores y candidata a la presidencia de Georgia. Bien, pues Salomé Zurabichvili, en el mes de junio del año 2000, cuando tuvimos las Torres Gemelas, en el 2011, ¿no? Pues aquí dijo con toda claridad que
las Torres
2001, aquí en junio del 2001, dijo que la respuesta a una guerra sin bajas propias, una guerra llevada básicamente a distancia, capaz de causar daños inadmisibles, tremendos, al adversario, al enemigo, tendría como respuesta la utilización del más sucio y más brutal de los terroristas, de los terrorismos, perdón, porque esa era la amenaza de los débiles. Nos puso muy bien, de manera muy clarividente, en antecedentes de lo que luego se plasmó en las Torres, en los atentados tremendos de las Torres Gemelas. Lo explicó muy bien. Después de tantos años de defendernos de los poderosos, ahora convenía atender a un asunto más grave, que era defendernos de los débiles. Y aquí también tuvimos a Gilles Disbier, por ejemplo, no voy a ser exhaustivo, que fue ministro de Asuntos Exteriores de Checoslovaquia y que de la Checoslovaquia todavía unida, que después tuvo responsabilidades en Naciones Unidas en los Balcanes, y le vimos también hacer una explicación de la situación de Kosovo, que entonces ardía, y presagiar que se produciría, como así sucedió año y pico después, que se produciría la proclamación unilateral de independencia de Kosovo, que semejante asunto era un verdadero desastre para los resultados de la Conferencia Europea de Seguridad y Cooperación y para el acuerdo de la no modificación, arbitraria de las fronteras, y que esa proclamación unilateral fuera de normas de Naciones Unidas y de todo, sin embargo, iba a tener el padrinazgo, iba a tener el respaldo, y por consiguiente se iba a abrir camino de los Estados Unidos de América, como así fue. De manera que yo estoy seguro que también este año, en esta ocasión, la vamos a recordar por algunas de las anticipaciones y de las cuestiones, hacia el futuro que van a plantear algunos de los que están convocados como panelistas, como conferenciantes. Este es un sistema dialogado. Cada uno de las sesiones o de los paneles concluye con preguntas a las cuales les animo a todos ustedes, y la elección del título y de el enfoque ciberamenazas y respuestas, yo creo que llega en un momento en que este asunto ha cobrado niveles de interés hasta el apasionamiento. Mientras tanto, además de recomendarles que echen un vistazo al libro que recoge los trabajos del año pasado, donde creo que encontrarán cuestiones de mucho interés, también aprovecho para recomendarles un libro muy breve, 90 páginas, se llama La sociedad de la transparencia. Está escrito por un coreano readaptado en Alemania, me parece, que se llama Byung-Chul Han, H-A-N, La sociedad de la transparencia. Está editado por Herder, una editorial de toda la vida. Bueno, ¿por qué? Porque hace una defensa inteligentísima de la opacidad. Empieza con una cita de Peter Handke que dice: vivo de aquello que los otros no saben de mí. Y luego les daré todavía dos pequeñas citas. Una que dice: sin duda el alma humana necesita esferas en las que pueda estar en sí misma, sin la mirada del otro. Y más adelante: está demostrado que más información no conduce de manera necesaria a mejores decisiones. ¿Cuántas veces hemos visto a nuestros amigos norteamericanos, a los que tanto debemos, estar sobreinformados y que eso no mejore sus decisiones? Está demostrado que más información no conduce de manera necesaria a mejores decisiones. La intuición, por ejemplo, va más allá de la información disponible y sigue su propia lógica. Hoy se atrofia la facultad superior de juzgar a causa de la creciente y pululante masa de información. Con frecuencia, un menos de saber e información produce un más. Bien, la negatividad de dejar y olvidar tiene no pocas veces un efecto productivo. La sociedad de la transparencia, queridos amigos, la sociedad de la transparencia no permite lagunas de información ni de visión, pero tanto el pensamiento como la inspiración requieren un vacío. Y una sociedad que no admitiera ya ninguna negatividad de un vacío sería una sociedad invivible. Y, por último, esta otra afirmación de que la teoría está cerca de la ceremonia que separa a los iniciados de los no iniciados. Desde luego, en este asunto de las ciberamenazas, la separación entre iniciados y no iniciados es asombrosa, radical. Pues muy bien, les deseo a todos ustedes una provechosa participación en este seminario, en el que procuraremos los organizadores dar la menor lata posible y facilitarles en todo su trabajo. Muchísimas gracias.
Gracias, Miguel Ángel. Entonces pasamos y ya comenzamos, sin más, ¿no? Sí. Aprovechar el tiempo, que sabemos que es muy valioso. Así que, por favor, Javier Fernández Arribas, que será el quien va a presentar a nuestro ponente, al señor Agustín. El señor Agustín, adelante y comenzamos.
Thank you. Buenos días a todos. Vamos a comenzar la primera ponencia de este Seminario Internacional sobre Seguridad y Defensa dedicado a las ciberamenazas y respuestas. Y en esta primera sesión vamos a hablar de la nueva amenaza. Nos defendemos de las amenazas, pero las amenazas cambian de modo acelerado. Es menos frecuente que el cambio se produzca en el formato de la amenaza. Parece generalizada la idea de que ahora hay una nueva variable en la ecuación de la seguridad, cuya magnitud se acrecienta al ritmo de las nuevas tecnologías. Se trata de la ciberseguridad, que en su aplicación al terreno militar llamamos ciberdefensa. En un momento en el que las amenazas han dejado de provenir solo de naciones identificadas y tienen origen en estados fallidos, grupos terroristas o incluso los denominados lobos solitarios, el recurso a los ciberataques supone un medio rápido y ágil que, sin necesidad de grandes movilizaciones de efectivos, vulneran la seguridad de nuestros países de manera sensible. Este uso de estrategias cibernéticas tiene efectos letales y no requiere el empleo de grandes medios económicos. Además, se ampara en el anonimato y limita la visibilidad gráfica de los conflictos, reduciendo el uso de la violencia al tiempo que se maximiza el daño. Se cumple así la máxima de Clausewitz, según la cual el conquistador es siempre un amante de la paz que preferiría sin duda someter nuestro país sin tener que combatir. En todo caso, parece claro que a partir de ahora las operaciones de guerra convencional estarán acompañadas de operaciones en el ciberespacio, y por no decir de las acusaciones que en los últimos tiempos se entrecruzan superpotencias como China y Estados Unidos en una serie de ataques, en una situación realmente preocupante en cuanto a lo que es la pugna por la hegemonía internacional. Para hablar de esta cuestión, la nueva amenaza, está con nosotros Greg Austin, miembro del Departamento de Estudios de Guerra del King College de Londres hasta hace unos días, y que nos va a hablar. Austin es miembro investigador del East West Institute de Nueva York, institución de la que ha sido vicepresidente de Seguridad Global. Es autor y coautor de diversas obras sobre las estrategias de China y Rusia, incluyendo todos los elementos de desarrollo militar y estrategia. Es especialista en lucha contra el terrorismo y crimen organizado en el marco del G8. Más recientemente ha sido líder del equipo de trabajo del Instituto encargado del estudio de la gobernanza global y ciberseguridad. En 2003, Greg Austin lideró el equipo de asesoramiento al gobierno británico para la prevención de conflictos. Ha trabajado para los gobiernos de Reino Unido y Australia. Él es originario de Australia. Sorry about the 3-0 de ayer. Pero España tenía que reivindicarse un poquito. Bueno, sirva esto para relajar un poco el comienzo de esta sesión. Señor Austin, tiene usted la palabra.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you, Javier. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you especially to Señor Diego Carcedo, the president of the Spanish section of the European Journalists Association, and Secretary General Miguel Ángel Aguilar for the invitation. I apologize that my presentation is in English, but I hope we can communicate nonetheless. China, Russia, and the United States agree on one thing: the information age, the application of advanced military technologies, has transformed national security. There is a new paradigm. Those states would also agree that the technology, like the criminals who exploit it, is advancing at a greater speed than most governments can demonstrate in responding to it. So my presentation today is about how can we close the gap between the fast pace of change in cyberspace and the slow pace of government response. In my presentation today, I'll look at two broad themes: the emerging threat landscape and the evolving response environment. I think we can all agree that planners in defence policy have been put under unusual stress as a result of the paradigm shift brought on by the information age. Before making some brief introductory remarks about the Institute, I want to offer a teaser about where the endpoint of this presentation will end. Three main hypotheses. One is that threats to the security of cyberspace in military and civil domains are increasing. In the last year, the international collaboration needed to address those threats has suffered severe setbacks, possibly irreversible. If the major powers are not talking about cyber space and cybersecurity in that area, do we have a global cybersecurity crisis? I want to introduce a little bit about the East-West Institute so that you might appreciate why I'm here talking to you today. The East-West Institute represents in cyberspace a novel form of international collaboration for military officers, corporations, and civil society on cyberspace issues, alluding to what the Secretary General said before about the origins of this seminar. Well, in cyberspace issues, it is time for the military to come out of the barracks. We can't afford to have the military sector isolated from civil society, from the corporations and governments in responding to threats in cyberspace. The East-West Institute was set up in 1980 at one of the peaks of the Cold War to catalyse private consultations between officials of NATO and Warsaw Pact and between the academic specialists of the two sides. The purpose was to bring the parties together for dialogue about the big issues of war and peace, but also to catalyse new thinking between the two sides. Our modus operandi was twofold: the private meetings and the knowledge and ideas generation. After our CEO, John Moroz, was recognised in 1990 by the German government for his role in helping to end the Cold War, we changed our focus of work to the political and economic liberalisation of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet bloc. But our modus operandi remained the same: bring people together to solve the problems and knowledge generation around ideas jointly developed. In 2005, we shifted our focus away from the Euro-Atlantic region to China, but we and big global issues such as counter-terrorism and energy security. But again, we kept the same focus: track two diplomacy, bringing sides together in private conversations, and knowledge generation around big ideas for policy change. We started our cyberspace cooperation work in 2010. After looking at it for a couple of years, we consulted with intelligence officials from China, Russia, the United States, India, and other governments to understand what the East-West Institute might be able to do. So we undertook a series of activities after that. We took the view that there were several inevitable characteristics of responding to cyber threats and governing cyberspace. I think you're all familiar with them. The response has to be collaborative, it has to be multinational, it has to be private-public, it has to be civil-military, and it has to be multidisciplinary. No one organisation can have all of the facts, let alone all of the answers. So my organisation tries to make a modest contribution through this thought leadership and private convenings from the various conflicting parties. You can note on these two slides, which I've just showed, listing some of our reports, that we've set up working groups between United States and Chinese officials on subjects like hacking and on spam, where in the future we hope to have similar working groups with the Chinese on things like protection of children online and protection of intellectual property rights. On a personal front, my own background is in defence intelligence. I spent 15 years working for Australian Defence Intelligence, which meant that I had regular and close collaboration with United States and UK intelligence officials, and I've just completed a book on cyber policy in China, so maybe we can talk about that in the question and answer a little. So turning to the future threat landscape, and I apologize if some of this material is familiar to some in the audience, but in order to establish a foundation for discussion today, I'd like to go over some familiar territory, but hopefully in an interesting fashion. One way into this issue of understanding the future threat landscape is to understand how the preeminent cyber power in the world views this set of issues. I'm talking about the United States. Since the United States is a trusted ally of Spain, Spain does not have to prepare necessarily its cyber defences against United States operations, but what I'm trying to say is that United States operations globally determine the operational environment for Spanish cyber operations. The reason for that is that if adversaries of the United States have to deal with United States cyber operations, United States cyber capabilities, and United States cyber planning, then those adversaries will come after allies of the United States so that they can better understand what the United States is doing and also weaken the value of that ally to the United States. And as importantly, this alliance relationship between Spain and the United States imposes a political burden-sharing arrangement on allies like Spain, because Spain, like other allies, has to bear the consequences of cyber operations by the United States globally. So we have a picture where, once upon a time, the allies of the United States could more or less operate in their own geography. The implication of being an ally of the United States in cyberspace is that these countries are now propelled onto a global stage in a global way, which was not the case before. So let's have a closer look at what the United States' view on information operations is. And here we have good sources. There is a declassified top secret document from the United States called Presidential Policy Directive No. 20, issued in October 2012. There's also the Joint Force Doctrine Manual on Information Operations, also of November 2012. These two documents do not use the word cyber war, rather they concentrate on cyber operations. But we have to note the scope of the United States concept of cyber operations. This top secret PPD 20, Presidential Directive 20, refers not just to the internet, to computers and networks, but also to telecommunications networks and processors and controllers in any automated system that can be operated remotely. So the United States' focus of information operations is about any machine which has a computerized component to it. Cyber operations in wartime, in the United States' view, seek to impair the confidentiality, integrity, or availability of the information itself, not just the machines. So the United States' concept of information operations is, as many in the room appreciate, on the one hand directed at machines and the code, and on the other hand it's directed at distorting, altering, and impacting the information environment as it's received by humans. These documents talk about the need to develop offensive cyber effect operations, and I want to read you a small quote from one of these documents which illustrates for me the paradigm shift associated with information operations. PPD 20, this top secret document which is leaked to the press, says that offensive cyber effect operations, quote, can offer unique and unconventional capabilities to advance United States national objectives around the world with little or no warning, with potential effects ranging from subtle to severely damaging. So the United States is setting a policy and operational environment for cyberspace which involves little or no warning to its adversaries and potential effects that range from subtle to severely damaging. So, as a military and intelligence ally of the United States, Spain, like Australia, is bound up in this operational environment of cyberspace. So to summarize the American position on this domain as it affects military affairs, we can reach the conclusion that cyberspace encompasses the entire fabric of strategic command and control and intelligence dissemination on which national military security depends. It also encompasses all other digital systems in use that affect military preparedness, including those in the critical civil infrastructure. So we're left with the conclusion that cyberspace is not a separate domain of warfare. It is where modern warfare will be won or lost. And it's worth noting in this connection that not only does the United States have an explicit doctrine of information dominance, but so does China, an explicit doctrine of information dominance. Russia does not have such an explicit doctrine of information dominance, but one might assume that it aspires to the same sorts of aspirations. So while Spain, therefore, was not in the front line in the NATO-Warsaw Pact confrontation during the Cold War, it is now much closer to the front lines of political confrontation in cyberspace. And just I would like to tick off a few examples of how Spain is involved in this global network. Spain is host to the 14th Internet Root Server and has been for over a decade. It is the landing destination of some 11 active undersea cables in a global network of more than 100. The undersea cable network carries 95% of all transoceanic communication, especially high-speed internet traffic. Spain is a critical landfall for half of the cables from the coast of West Africa and half of the undersea cables linking Egypt, the Levant and the Persian Gulf to Europe and the United States. The undersea cable communications infrastructure is one of the most vulnerable elements of cyberspace. In any military conflict, and even in pre-conflict stages, the communications cable infrastructure will be a very high priority target for any adversaries. Spain is also host to one of three critical ground stations for NASA's deep space probes, and it hosts a number of ground stations for the US military C4 ISTAR network. The new director of the United States National Security Agency, Admiral Mike Rogers, served in a cyber-related capacity at Rota Naval Base in Spain. So we really have to conclude from these sort of small examples that Spain, as an ally and partner of the United States, is on the front line for the protection of the global communication system that underpins economic and financial systems of the global community. The threat landscape is not exclusively about cyber war, and this is one of the challenges of setting national security policies for cyberspace. Non-military aspects are as important, and I'd like to just run through what three different organisations have said about the emerging threat landscape to facilitate discussion for today. So there's a European 2020 project of the International Cybersecurity Protection Alliance, which in cooperation with Europol put together its understanding of the future threat landscape. It identified some 19 different characteristics of the future threat landscape, and I've drawn out just 9 here which are of more interest to this group. So looking forward, we can anticipate more interest in cyber attacks on unmanned vehicles and robotic devices. We can anticipate more electronic attacks on critical infrastructure. We can expect physical attacks on data centres and internet exchanges, not to mention landfall stations for undersea cables. We should expect the emergence of more and more incidents of cyber-enabled violence against individual people. What this means is penetrating systems and manipulating them so that things like aircraft, transport networks, and other critical infrastructure break down in such a way that it brings about the death of people using those facilities. And then we're getting into sort of more complex areas like the mature market for illicit virtual items, biohacks for multi-factor authentication components, high political impact targeted identity theft, and sophisticated reputation manipulation. So we can see glimmers of all of this today, but in the future this organisation is saying this is going to come much more intensely, and these are going to be very important determinants of our future operating environment. Oops, there we go. Pushed the wrong button, sorry.
You suffer a cyber attack.
Yes. Right. Okay, so turning to a more simpler framing of the future threat environment, an Australian organisation put together these three bullets, which I think, in a sense, simplify the threat environment, but in a sense, highlight the increasing severity of the threat environment. They talk about a growing number of threat vectors, an evolving sophistication, and an increased accessibility of threat tools. Especially through the marketing of particular malware and the like. And why this is a good way of, in a sense, representing to policymakers and to funders the fact that organisations which are charged with responding to threats in cyberspace really have to receive more funding and more attention. And that's a dilemma which is emerging in all countries. To put it even more simply, talking about the future threat environment, the World Economic Forum in January this year talked about the danger of complete fragmentation of the internet and suggested that the world may be only one disruptive technology away from attackers gaining a runaway advantage, meaning the internet would cease to be a trusted medium for communications or commerce. Well, not everybody agrees with this. In fact, most people don't agree with this. But it's worth bearing in mind. At the same time, the people who are critical of this framing by the World Economic Forum do believe that the accumulation of threats to confidence in the internet are sufficient, that it is reasonable to talk about a gradual fragmentation of the internet and a gradual loss of confidence. So where does that leave us in respect of the evolving response environment? While circumstances differ from country to country, it's possible to offer some generalisable observations about the policy environment. And to do that, I really don't want to bore you with my own personal assessments. I want to draw again on some more specialist assessments. And for the sake of this argument, I'm drawing on an assessment by the United States Department of Homeland Security. And I've got three slides here which capture their assessment of the future operational policy environment. So we've talked about the first one already, which is the idea of new security and deterrence paradigms. I mean, this is fundamentally important. It's why the United States created a cyber command. I guess it's why Spain created a cyber command. But to understand the penetration and the new impact of this paradigm shift, to see it play out in different countries, we have to, in a sense, ask the question, have all countries shifted quickly enough, and have they shifted in a paradigmatic fashion? The second point is one you're all familiar with, about the need for strong international collaboration. The Department of Homeland Security also identified the increasing volume and sophistication of cyber threats as demanding heightened situational awareness, secure implementation of technology, coordinated incident response, and demonstrated resilience in critical functions. These things sound like what the Americans might call apple pie. Everybody does it. Everybody knows it. But at some point, we've got to be able to test whether the level of response meets the level of the threat. And the second bullet here on this page from the Department of Homeland Security about a professionalized cybersecurity workforce that is dynamically managed is a particularly demanding aspect of the future policy response environment. There is no country in the world which has enough people in its national borders to defend itself in cyberspace. The United States does not have enough people to do all of the jobs it wants, it needs done. China does not have enough people to defend all of the things it wants to defend in cyberspace. And countries like Australia and I suspect Spain similarly face this very big challenge in how to manage a cyberspace defence workforce. And this third slide, picking up the last two points from the Department of Homeland Security, talks about the deepening social, economic and industrial dependence on information and the increasing number of users. So the world is becoming cyberized. So the defence of cyberspace is just facing this exponential explosion of use and activity. Against that environment, the final point that the Department of Homeland Security makes about the future policy response environment is that we have to depend very much on risk management approaches, and we have to understand the difference in approaches between different countries and different organisations. I'll go back to the 2020 project that I mentioned earlier, this European project, which identified some rather interesting aspects of the future policy environment. And some of these will be familiar to you. The idea that their new technological powers will emerge, that some countries might achieve leapfrog effects in disruptive technologies. But the second one is quite interesting. It's the proposition that internet diplomacy and international diplomacy become one and the same. So are we in a situation where, if there's a rupture in diplomacy about cyberspace, does that represent a rupture in diplomacy about international security? I'll come back to that later. So there's some other ones there which we might be familiar with, like the proposition that countries with low levels of cybersecurity become no-go areas for criminals. There'll be increasing tension between governments and multinational corporations, a situation we already see now in the United States in the wake of the Snowden revelations. We'll see more attacks on critical infrastructure, but citizens will demand greater voice on these big issues. So the primary message out of all of this is that wide-ranging and collaborative international action has to be an essential part of any country's national security policy in cyberspace. So, returning to this original teaser observation that I mentioned at the start, are we facing a global cyberspace crisis? The United States and Russia, after only recently establishing a dialogue process at official level on cyberspace cooperation under the Presidential Commission in June 2013, suspended the Presidential Commission dialogue in April this year as a result of the Russian annexation of Crimea. Why this is really important is that in 1998, President Yeltsin and President Clinton met and, among other subjects, decided that it was important for Russia and the United States to establish a dialogue on cyberspace. That didn't happen until 2009-2010. So we had a delay already of 12 or 13 years. Around 2009-2010, they got together, they started negotiating some confidence-building measures in cyberspace. They reached a very important agreement for a hotline in cyberspace, especially as part of the Nuclear Risk Reduction Center. That has now been suspended because of the US-Russia crisis over Crimea. So in 1998, the president said it's important. By 2010, they'd reached some agreement, and now it's off the table again. So the United States and Russia are no longer in official dialogue on cyberspace cooperation. The United States and China, as a result of the United States indictment of five PLA personnel on charges of cyber espionage against the United States, China suspended the only recently opened US-China dialogue on cyberspace cooperation. So it was June 2013, China and the United States agreed to open an official dialogue channel on cyberspace cooperation with all sorts of threats and issues in the background, military, political, economic. Well, in just 1 or 2 months ago, in response to the indictment of these five PLA personnel by the United States federal court, China suspended that dialogue. So that's two components of the international collaboration system for cyberspace, which are now in suspension. So then we come to the case of Edward Snowden. And Edward Snowden has created a major impact on trust in cyberspace and on international collaboration in cyberspace. We can see how it's affected relations between the United States and some of its key allies, such as Germany, some of its important international friends, such as Brazil, but how it's deepened Russian and Chinese intention to match the United States in cyberspace. So the Chinese government had no illusions about the power of the United States in cyberspace. But once the Snowden revelations came out, it hardened Chinese determination to try and match the United States in cyberspace. In February this year, China made the declaration that it will become a cyber great power. China had never said that before February 2014. There's a long history of why it said that and what it means, but it means an important change. Another important effect of the Snowden revelations is a pronounced shift by United States-based multinationals away from voluntary collaboration with the United States government. The 9 corporations named by Edward Snowden in his leaks about PRISM now have visibly altered relations of trust with the United States government. Talk to any of their executives, they'll tell you their trust in the United States government is very, very different from what it was before Snowden. Talk to officials in the Chinese government and they'll tell you the same story. Their trust in those US-based multinational corporations has gone down dramatically. And then, of course, there is a shift in public trust relations towards all intelligence agencies as a result of the Snowden revelations. So I think we could make a case that we do have a global crisis in cyberspace, but perhaps we can talk about that a little bit later. In offering the teaser idea that we might have this crisis, that these effects are perhaps irreversible, I really want to just come back to the proposition, well, this makes the East-West Institute just a little bit more determined to try and bring about some change. So we're continuing our work with these governments, with the Chinese government, the Russian government, the United States government, and with the leading corporations, and we're working across these areas. As I mentioned earlier, this is a novel form of collaboration between military officials, leading corporations, civil society, and leading governments. And as I said before, if the military are involved in protection of cyberspace, they have to come out of the barracks. It can't be done in the purely military sphere. It really does represent a new form of activity. The East-West Institute has set up a number of what we call breakthrough groups, which bring together representatives of armed forces, corporations, governments, and the private and the civil society to address some of these questions. We're working on these specific working groups right now. They're open to participation by anyone with an interest or a specialisation, and we'll be taking forward the work of these breakthrough groups to a summit in Berlin being co-hosted by the German Foreign Office in December this year. And the importance of that is that we need the collaboration of governments and the high-level support of governments to help deliver these new solutions. And we found a high degree of take-up and interest in our work from corporations, governments, and military representatives. But enough of the East-West Institute. I think to finish the presentation, I'd just really like to return to the main question which I've posed. Do we have a global crisis? Do we have a crisis in global cyberspace? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Muchas gracias, señor Austin. Creo que hay muchos temas encima de la mesa, además bien documentados. Y el papel de España, señor Austin, nos deja en una situación bastante interesante por un lado, pero por otro lado bastante delicada por otro. Pero bueno, quien quiere peces tiene que mojarse los tobillos. Preguntas por ahí, por favor.
Hi, my name is Jens Müller. I'm from the German Embassy. Thank you, Greg, for your presentation. I would like to focus on East-West Institute and the collaboration with China. because you mentioned, as some of us already know, the information dominance document of China government. And you mentioned in your presentation, China has not enough people to defend whatever their domains. I would rather say China has not enough people to attack all targets they have all over the world. So when East-West Institute is collaborating with China in their working groups, what are you aiming for? For me, that seems to be like sleeping with the enemy. I don't see that we'll find a common sense about cyberspace with China, because they're not aiming for armed forces or the Ministry of Defense. They're aiming to the economy of the Western countries. So what's the topic behind the East-West Institute working group with China?
Thanks, a very good question. And I guess you'll forgive me if I say it's a multi-level question with a multi-level response. So the Chinese government, like the Spanish government or the United States government, has a range of interests across political, military, economic, security, and social domains. It's quite clear that there is a difference of values between the United States and China on almost all of those issues. The established policy priority of both governments of the United States and China is to promote peaceful economic collaboration and to promote prosperity and to avoid conflict. The cyber policies of both governments, of each government, the cyber policy of each government creates severe anxiety in the other government. So that on the United States part, it takes very seriously China's use of cyberspace in two domains. One is the suppression of human rights at home and the use of the internet to suppress human rights at home, and the use of cyber espionage for the various purposes that we all know about. The United States does not take so seriously, and trust me on this, the United States does not take so seriously China's military capability in cyberspace. Okay, so when we turn to China, the situation is somewhat reversed and quite different. The Chinese government is extremely concerned about the use by United States-based organizations for what it regards as subversion of the legitimate Chinese government. So whether we agree with that or not, that's how it thinks. And in second space, it sees itself as very much a non-competitive. It's very non-competitive with the United States in military applications of cyberspace and information war. For China, the United States is a cyber superpower. China sees its own military capabilities in cyberspace as right down here. There are many analysts who agree with that assessment. So if you're China and you're faced with a country like the United States who you see as your adversary, the United States has something like 30 to 40 cyber allies. The United States has 30 to 40 countries which it can call on as cyber allies. By itself, the United States is a cyber superpower. China is here by itself, not a single ally, not a single cyberspace ally, and by itself, and very weak in military applications of cyberspace. What would you do if you were the Chinese government? You'd do a lot of espionage, and whether or not you're doing commercial espionage is another thing. So with that background, what is the East-West Institute trying to do? The East-West Institute is trying to bring these two countries together so that the misunderstanding that arises between them about the relative power situation in cyberspace can be resolved, and so some of the bad practices on both sides can be modulated. It's not possible for the United States to get everything it wants from the Chinese in cyberspace. If it keeps trying, it will get nothing. And we've seen the result of that with the suspension of the talks between the United States and China. So what are we out to get in the, from the East-West Institute? In the balance between military affairs and economic and political affairs in the United States-China relationship, military affairs is a low priority. The absolute highest priority for the Chinese government and the United States government in the relationship is the economic relationship. And what do we see in cyberspace and in advanced information technology between China and the United States government is we have seen a willingness on the part of the United States since 1983 to provide almost everything China needs for its modernization in information technology. We've seen a great flood of American-based multinationals into China. China is now the biggest producer of PCs in the world. China can register all sorts of firsts in cyberspace. But China's information technology industry is very dependent on global cooperation. It's very dependent on the United States multinationals. China's exports in the ICT sector are highly dependent on US and Western-based multinationals. So we have a situation where Chinese espionage is going on, all these cyber attacks are happening beyond any shadow of doubt. But, you know, balanced against that is this situation where since 1983, the United States and China are totally interdependent in terms of their ICT sectors. The dependence of China on the United States is far higher than the dependence of the United States on China, which is why the United States can afford to do these things like bring charges against the Chinese PLA personnel. So it's a long answer. What we're trying to achieve is bring about some common understanding of that and bring about action where it's in, where it's possible. So we have this dialogue on spam, we have this dialogue on hacking, we have some conversations at the high military level with the Central Military Commission on what does cyber espionage really mean. But it's a very slow process. So anyway, that's a long answer to your very short question. Thank you.
Una respuesta muy interesante. ¿Más preguntas? Sí, Pedro González.
Pedro González, de Zoom News. Yo quisiera insistir en el tema que usted ha apuntado respecto del impacto que ha tenido las revelaciones hechas por Edward Snowden. El viernes pasado, en concreto la Cámara de Representantes de los Estados Unidos, ha aprobado, justamente aprovechando la aprobación del presupuesto militar para 2015, ha aprobado una enmienda según la cual pues prácticamente limita el poder de la NSA de recolectar datos y de almacenarlos. En principio, bueno, este impacto, ¿juzga usted primero que esto puede tener, puede llegar a fondo, es decir, que el Senado aprobará una resolución idéntica y el presidente Barack Obama no se opondrá a ello, con lo cual entraría en vigor, o piensa que naturalmente volveríamos a la casilla de salida? Pero aparte de eso, ¿qué juicio político le merece justamente estas revelaciones de Snowden, que se han puesto patas arriba todo el sistema de la lucha y del ciberespacio, de alguna manera también ha provocado una reacción en los legisladores que ven amenazada su privacidad y su propia libertad ciudadana?
Oh, thank you for that question. I'm not familiar with the exact language of the resolutions before the United States Congress, but I can observe that the attitudes of the Congress and of the President towards NSA surveillance have changed dramatically between June last year, when the revelations were first made by Edward Snowden, and January the 17th this year. On January 17th this year, President Obama said, "History has shown that governments cannot be trusted to protect the civil liberties of their citizens without appropriate checks and balances." So President Obama himself has signaled that there had to be an end to what was happening. His administration feels clearly now, as do many members of Congress, that the situation as it was happening before Snowden made the revelations was probably incompatible to a significant degree with normal American understanding of what was needed and what was valuable. So I think that there is strong support in the United States for a limitation of NSA powers. As I mentioned before, the corporations, multinational corporations based in the United States, have completely changed their attitudes towards voluntary cooperation with the United States intelligence agencies. They will now do in the United States what they do in countries like China and France and Spain. They will strictly observe the rules and the laws of the land, but they will not any longer offer voluntary cooperation that goes beyond the strict rule of law requirement. So that, I guess that would be my answer to your question, is if that answers it adequately.
Yo quería plantearle, señor Austin, que nos pusiera más en antecedentes, más detalles sobre el riesgo que puede tener España, como usted ha dicho, que está en primera línea por ser un aliado de los Estados Unidos.
That's a good question. As I was driving into very lovely Toledo, thinking about how far Spain is from Russia and how far Spain is from China and even from the United States, I was thinking, well, yeah, is Spain really on the front lines in cyberspace? It certainly wasn't on the front lines in the Cold War in the same way that a country like Germany was. But when I think about it, especially, for example, take the role of the Spanish banks in the global economy today. Spain is a member of the G7, I believe, certainly a member of the G20. And the so Spain is not an insignificant economic actor, and the volume of transactions in the financial services sector globally and the way in which those transactions occur is fundamentally important to the security of cyberspace globally. So there are these interdependencies which I mentioned. So I certainly think that Spain is a player, but it's a player in all sorts of ways. It's not simply because there's a piece of infrastructure in Spain that needs to be protected or that Spanish banks participate in the global economy. It's really because there are a range of activities which might happen under Spanish jurisdiction which are important to other actors in the global economy. So whether or not that's criminals operating from Spain, Spanish territory or not, it's one sort of question. The other side of the coin is that if all countries don't collaborate in cyberspace, all countries may not collaborate in cyberspace, but all countries would be affected by a serious crisis in cyberspace. So the ability, for example, of the United States to extradite criminals, cyber criminals from China, has never been good. It was improving, and there were some recent cases in the last couple of years where the United States could extradite cyber criminals from China. But in the current environment, is it possible for countries like the United States to get from China or Russia information it might need to stop a criminal attack on, say, a United States bank? So where does Spain sit in that situation? So as Spain deepens its cyber cooperation with the United States, as it should, then does that impact on Spain's ability to have meaningful security dialogue on issues important to Spain in respect of cyberspace? So I wouldn't overplay it, but we're all part of the global system and all part of the global economy.
¿Y eso incluye el escudo, el acuerdo sobre el escudo antimisiles? Entiendo que forma parte de toda la política de cooperación entre los dos países.
Between Spain and the United States. I'm a little bit out of touch on that, but that's an important area. The prospect of a military confrontation between China and the United States is quite small. Similarly, the prospect of a military confrontation between Russia and the United States and Russia and NATO is quite small, very small. But that doesn't mean that the espionage services of these countries are not very interested. Outer space is the biggest domain where information warfare will take place. So I've talked about the undersea cables carrying 95% of transoceanic communications, especially high-speed internet traffic. But in terms of military planning of the United States, it's the satellites and outer space which are fundamentally important. Without satellites and outer space, the United States loses its cyber superiority. The Chinese government knows that. It's rapidly moving to escalate its space-based activity. And I'm sure Russia knows that as well. I haven't paid as much attention. So participation in something like anti-ballistic missile defenses exposes an ally to, you know, cyber espionage in the same way that we would understand in the past. It's perhaps not a big deal, but it's just one of many facets of the cyberspace.
Felipe Sahagún, por favor.
Muchas gracias. Le quería comentar, recuerdo hace muchos años, creo que fue en 92, asistí a un seminario con John Moroz en Salzburgo sobre lo que estaba pasando al final de la Unión Soviética. Y recuerdo que él acababa de nacer, no me daba cuenta yo de que acababa de nacer el East West Institute, pero me parecía que el hombre con el que colaboraba y del que dependía para la información y el trabajo en Moscú en ese momento, porque vino y fue uno de nuestros profesores, era Alexei Arbatov. Entonces estaba pensando si en este momento la red de la que dependen para el trabajo es también con personas, con fuentes de información, capacidad, conocimiento, como era Arbatov y ha sido muchos años, con el presidente del Comité de Defensa en la Duma, el instituto que él dirigía, en fin, si trabajan igual en este caso. Pero bueno, si me podía hacer un comentario, si el instituto sigue basándose en personal local para ese trabajo. Anteayer escuché a la ministra de Defensa alemana, no recuerdo si fue la BBC o la CNN, y le preguntaba el entrevistador cómo se estaba resolviendo el conflicto con Alemania. Entonces ella decía, a saber, entre aliados, esto es una cosa de familia, muy diplomática, ¿no? Entonces, vamos, no llegará la sangre al río, vamos a ver. No dio detalles, pero reconoció que se habían pasado, en español decimos, 1000 pueblos, los americanos, y que eso no podía seguir así, y que las reglas de juego tenían que cambiar, el modus vivendi, por lo que nos jugamos en valores, en comercio, en la renovación de todo el sistema transatlántico, etcétera, etcétera. Le quería preguntar si realmente tiene usted algún dato que dé a entender que la relación, esa relación después de todo el escándalo, se está encarrilando en una buena dirección. Y si entiende por qué en España, en cambio, la reacción ha sido tan silenciosa. Prácticamente no ha habido reacción. Ha dicho que todos tenemos escasos instrumentos, pocos recursos humanos para atender a esta amenaza. Pero al mismo tiempo vemos cómo se han ido creando en muy pocos años, entre 2 y 5 años, en Estados Unidos en primer lugar, departamentos independientes, prácticamente cuerpos de ejército distintos, nuevos, para atender a esto. Y yo lo que le quería preguntar es, a mí me da la impresión de que se está viendo como, digamos, un instrumento independiente de todos los demás, con una responsabilidad, y en cambio, con una responsabilidad, digamos, de supervisión, pero ajena, separada del resto de la administración, de la burocracia. Cuando el problema, yo cada vez lo siento más, pero no soy un experto, como parte de toda la infraestructura, de toda la burocracia, creo que esto de crear divisiones de ejército especializadas para responsabilizarse de esta amenaza, me parece que es menos eficaz que si se viera como algo que tiene que estar dentro de todo el cuerpo
social, industrial, burocrático, y que desde ese punto de vista no se están haciendo las cosas bien y lo vamos a pagar caro. Pero me puedo equivocar. Y por último, Snowden. Hace meses que escuché al presidente de la Comisión de Justicia criticando durísimamente lo que representaba para las libertades la información que nos había permitido conocer Snowden. Lo que, al mismo tiempo, los directores de los medios de comunicación que han trabajado con los documentos primero de WikiLeaks y luego de Snowden, pues han estado sometidos a una persecución tremenda y a unas presiones muy fuertes, como ustedes saben. Usted sabe. Los del Guardian lo han revelado, los de New York Times lo han contado, todo el mundo, ¿no? Lo que le quería preguntar es si cree que los medios de comunicación que han publicado estos documentos han actuado correctamente, si cree que nos hemos quedado cortos y si hay alguna posibilidad de dar marcha atrás. No sé si es permitir que Snowden vuelva y se le dé amnistía, quizás sea muy fuerte, pero ¿cómo cree usted que se podría reconducir esta gravísima crisis entre la seguridad y el aparato que tiene que administrarla y los medios de comunicación responsables de dar a conocer a la sociedad la información que cree que hay que dar a conocer? Perdone por la extensión de...
Sí, que tenemos para otra hora. Yo le voy a pedir respuestas muy directas y concretas. Tenemos pedidas dos palabras. Nos hemos pasado un poquito de tiempo, pero vamos a respetar esas dos peticiones de palabra y ya hacemos luego la pausa para el café para no restar tiempo a la siguiente mesa. Sure. Señor Rostin.
Thanks. Good questions. I'll be very brief. We do use experts like Abatov very closely. He was Alexei Abatov, the son, was member of our board of directors for some time. On the German situation, it will never be the same again in terms of public trust in the United States. It doesn't mean that Germany will not remain a faithful ally militarily, but public trust in Germany of the United States will never be the same again. On NSA and the bureaucracies, the United States government has created many specialized bureaucracies. Other governments have not done the same thing. I think there's room to question whether, as you suggest, that the United States might have chosen a different path apart from creating specialized agencies. So... And on the Snowden question, did the media do the right thing? I think that's for the media to judge. I certainly think it was an important set of revelations, which obviously changed public policy. So I personally, and that's just a personal opinion, I supported the revelations and the fact that they came out. So thank you.
Juan Cuesta.
Sí, buenos días. Veo aquí dos aspectos. Uno, el que tiene que ver con la defensa que los estados hacen de sus sistemas de información y del contenido de esa información, y hay mucha gente pensando en buscar soluciones para esto. Y otro aspecto, que es la defensa que los ciudadanos deberíamos tener frente a la voracidad o a la insaciabilidad de los estados por controlar también la información que circula entre los ciudadanos, nuestra privacidad. ¿Quién piensa en esto? ¿Quién piensa en este otro aspecto? ¿Y de qué manera podríamos acotar o controlar la barra libre, digamos, de los estados a la hora de controlar la información de los ciudadanos? Gracias.
Thanks. Good question. Perhaps an unusually short answer. I used to work in intelligence agencies, so I have a little bit of trust in what the NSA and other organizations do with their information. I do agree with President Obama that at the end of the day, governments can't be trusted without checks and balances. In modern cyberspace, the bigger threat to you or me is from criminals, not from governments like the United States or the Spanish government. Even if the United States, the Spanish government, or the Australian government are doing bad things in cyberspace, I'm far less worried about what they are doing than what the criminals are doing. And our inability collectively to deal with criminal behavior in cyberspace and this looming threat of reputational manipulation, I think, are very serious threats. So it doesn't answer your question. I think that public scrutiny of the intelligence agencies is a fundamentally important element of what we should do. And if Edward Snowden helped that, that's important. It's important for each country to have a public debate. But at the end of the day, I think we are well served by our intelligence agencies, even if they make mistakes from time to time. So, but yeah, so there are things that have to be done.
La última y al fondo.
Soy Antonio Regalado de ABC Toledo.
Aquí, te has dejado barba, no te conocía, Antonio.
Una pregunta muy sencilla. ¿Qué papel pueden jugar los drones para prevenir esas ciberamenazas o son en sí mismas unas amenazas, los drones?
Good question. Looking forward, I think we all have to understand better what uses these unmanned aerial vehicles can be put to. There will be many examples in the future, I'm sure, of where these are used to abuse our privacy and to undertake all sorts of surreptitious and illegal activities. We need to know what they're doing. But drones are only one example of robotic implements, which also in the future will be a very big source of concern, especially since they're controlled by cyberspace and subject to attack and manipulation. So, yes, we should be worried, I think. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señor Austin. Thank you very much. Tenemos ahora una pausa para tomar un café, 20-25 minutos, para dar paso luego a la segunda mesa del día sobre la ciberdefensa en España. Muchas gracias.